Hello and welcome to the stories that brought you here. It's the podcast dedicated to the people living in the southwest corner of British Columbia, in and around a place called the Salish Sea. I am your host, Chris Wakaluk, and it's my pleasure to get to sit down in one-on-one conversations with residents from this area to hear the stories that brought them to this beautiful part of the world we live in, and to also hear the stories that brought them to the point that they're at in their lives right now. Today, I will be speaking with Adam Olson. Now, if you know Adam like I know Adam, then you're going to know him as our local MLA for the North Saanich and Southern Gulf Islands. But today, we're going to get to learn a lot more about Adam. He'll talk about his experience growing up as part of the Sartlip First Nation on the Saanich Peninsula. He'll also talk about his parents' involvement in a couch and sweater business and the work a couple family members did making the legendary Victoria Moss hanging baskets. He'll also describe the lessons that he learned from one of his first jobs as being a server and how that aided him years down the road when he became a politician. He'll talk about his pursuit early on in life to become a hockey play-by-play announcer. Adam will also talk about the stigma around substance abuse in our society. All that and more in a really amazing interview that I'm so happy I got to do. And as I mentioned right off the top of the show, Adam was kind enough to come visit me at my home on Pender Island, and it was a real pleasure to talk to him. I've interviewed people on this podcast before who are involved in local politics, but those individuals I've known as friends first and politicians second. And for me personally, I think that I've done a real disservice to myself in the past by really having a limited view of politicians and sort of not necessarily seeing them as individuals, but seeing them as just that, simply a politician. And that's what this podcast is actually all about. It's about getting to know people on a more intimate and deeper level so that we're able to really see through the superficialities and get a deeper, caring view about the individuals in our community. Because we're surrounded by beautiful people, and I really like having an opportunity to get to highlight who people are so we can really learn to care about each other more. So thank you for tuning in. If this is your first time here, welcome. If you are a returning listener, here's my very first ad read, and it's for Picciolino Pizza. It's a great new restaurant on Pender Island that's serving authentic Neapolitan pizza. It's wood-fired, it literally takes a few minutes to cook, and it is delicious. I can remember when I was a kid growing up in Burnaby, my dad would drive half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever it took to drive down to Main Street and pick up a wood-fired pizza because he thought it was the best. And I guess that's where I got my love of wood-fired pizza. And this particular pizza that they're serving is amazing. I haven't had pizza like this since the last time I was in Italy. And that was over 20 years ago. They are located at the historic Pender Island Golf and Country Club. They're open Tuesday through Sunday from 1 p.m. till 7 p.m. And they have a beautiful patio that overlooks the golf course, and it's a great place to hang out and eat some delicious pizza. So if you live on Pender and you haven't had a chance to check them out, I highly recommend them. If you're off island and you've been thinking about coming over to Pender for a day trip, well, it's just a 2-minute drive from the ferry terminal or a 20-minute walk. Once again, that's Picciolino Pizza, located at 2305 Otter Bay Road. Lastly, if this is your first time to the podcast and you like what you hear, there's numerous ways to listen. You can listen on Spotify. You can listen through Apple Podcasts. You can also go through Podbean, where it's easy to subscribe. And if you want to find out about future interviews coming up, one of the best ways to do that is through my Facebook page called The Stories That Brought You Here - Pender Island. And you'll find updates as to when new interviews are coming out. And I'm really excited about the direction that this podcast is taking and some of the people that I'm going to get a chance to interview. So please stay tuned for that. And I think we're done with the intro here. So first, a little music, and then my interview with Adam Olson. This is the part where I say, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, okay. So currently we're on Pender Island right now. You did me the service of coming to my house to do an interview with me, and I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, the timing worked out perfectly, and I've been on island all morning, 35 minutes later than I wanted to be because the Queen of Cumberland had a bit of a delay this morning. So, you know, as a constituency MLA, I got to experience ferry delays and been meeting with constituents all morning. And I'm really happy that that I get a chance to just hang out with you and have this conversation.
Yeah, me too. Me too. We've had a little chat so far just before we started, and it's been really good so far. Okay, well, let's get into the traditional first question that this podcast is about, and that's traditionally what brought you to Pender Island, but I'm branching out and we're going to be asking you what brought you to Vancouver Island.
Well, I've got long, deep roots on Vancouver Island and the Saanich Peninsula in particular. I'm a Saanich person, a Saanich person, and my family has been kicking around the Salish Sea here, the Southern Gulf Islands, and Saanich Peninsula since, as we say, since time immemorial for countless generations. And I live on the exact same property that my mom and dad brought me home to when I was born in 1976. My sister lives in the house that we grew up in. It's a very different structure than it was. It was a double wide trailer, and it's now a multi-story, multi-dimensional living space for her and her family. And I live in the backyard where we had greenhouses when I grew up in through the 1980s and 1990s. We had a garden maintenance and hanging basket business. That business ended about 2014. And my wife and I built a house in the backyard right where the greenhouses were. So I haven't gone far. What brought me here was birth. And I don't think that I'm going to go too far from this. So I'm going to leave here probably the natural way as well.
Okay. What was your childhood experience like growing up in that particular situation with that kind of background? I guess if you could sort of fill myself in the public as to being of First Nations descent, what your experiences were like?
Well, I'm a Saanich person, but I'm a mixed heritage person. And so I had a variety of experiences growing up on an Indian reserve in Canada. I had parents that did a lot of business in the community, had a couple of businesses, the garden maintenance business, and also a couch and Indian sweater business that they operated through that same period of the 1980s, 1990s. And so, you know, I had kind of my feet on both sides of the ditch, as my mom likes to say, characterize it. But I grew up very much connected to our community. And so definitely surrounded by people who you know, I grew up with their kids. I grew up with them. And my first foray into local government in Central Saanich was the first time that someone from, you know, Sartlip had ever ventured out into municipal politics. But really, those relationships in community are what got me elected in that first election back in 2008. So I have very fond memories of growing up on the Saanich Peninsula. I have very fond memories of our connections to the places here in the Salish Sea. And so I'm very much a son or a product of this place. And you know, it's kind of a natural extension for me to be doing what I'm doing now as someone who's advocating for it and someone who's standing up and being a voice for this place. So kind of a natural extension for me.
Okay. You mentioned that your parents had a couch and sweater making business?
Well, we didn't make them. In fact, my parents, my grandmother, Tiquat, Laura Olson, my dad's mom, was a knitter and knit all of those beautiful things that you've seen the Strait Salish, the Coast Salish families knitting. Socks and toques and sweaters and vests and all those products. My grandmother was a real innovator with wool. And of course, the Strait Salish people have a long history with wool working, have a long history with blanket making. And so that really came through to our family. My mom's an author. She's written about it. My sister's an amazing, Joni is an amazing wool worker as well. And so they owned a business called Mount Newton Indian Sweaters. And that business was actually a fair trade business where there was recognition that the souvenir shops in downtown Victoria were giving ridiculously low prices, low value for the products that were being knit by my relatives, by my ancestors, Salhuin as we recognize them. And so, you know, my mom and dad, this was my dad's experience, seeing his relatives basically getting ripped off by the souvenir shops in downtown Victoria. So they said, you know what, we're just going to disrupt this marketplace. We'll just start buying these sweaters. And that's what they did. They started buying the sweaters. And then they formed a relationship with the wool mill in Cowichan, Sarah Modeste and her family, and they bought wool. And we would go up to Cowichan, we'd buy a whole van load of wool, we'd bring it down, and the knitters would come with their products, sell us their products, we'd sell them the wool, they'd go away, they'd knit more products. And eventually we started having just piles and piles of sweaters all around, and really it was my parents' desire to give a fair price for the product that was being made. And then my mom and dad went on a road trip and met a buyer of these sweaters who owned souvenir shops in Whistler, Banff, and Jasper. And at the time, and it's still probably the case, but at the time, there were a lot of tour buses that would land in, you know, tourists land in Vancouver, get on a bus, come over here, go to Butchart's. Not here.
Yeah, yeah.
In the Sandwich Peninsula.
For sure, yeah.
I'm on Pender. And then get on the ferry and head out to the Rockies. And it was like a 3 or 4 day bus trip. And they sold hundreds and hundreds, thousands of handmade Coast Salish knit sweaters and products. And my parents bought them, zippered some of them, left some of them as pullovers. And we packaged them up. I remember going to bed at night listening to the spinning wheel, you know, spinning wool, or the Singer sewing machine, my mom putting in zippers. I could go to bed listening to that sound today. It was put you right to sleep. So that's my experience growing up with those businesses. That business came from clearly my father's side of the family. And then from the other side of my family, my grandfather was this remarkable, Don Snowden was his name. He was this remarkable gardener, and very similar kind of in both sides of my family. We have this very close connection to the earth, very close connection to the water, to the soil, to the land. And my grandfather was this just remarkable horticulturalist. And he left us, or we took over his business building the legendary Greater Victoria moss hanging baskets. And we did that right up until, I think, like I said, 2013, 2014, before that business shut down because my sister wanted to go back to school. So, you know, there's a variety of other reasons too, but that was the main reason. And we built those for 35 years, and not a handful of baskets. Like my mom and sister made 800, 900 moss hanging baskets. So
that's a lot of
it was quite
baskets.
quite a production, and we had a lot of customers and commercial and individuals. And so both sides of my family lineage contributed to the economics of our household, but as well to kind of laying the groundwork for me to be able to be in public office and have those relationships with people that I treasure so much now.
Wow. Okay. So what I'm hearing from you is that family's pretty close to you.
Well, interesting you should say that, because the property that I live on today has my sister and her husband and their three kids. It has our brother, Joak, my sister, Heather, and her family live on a different property, but her daughter, my niece, Yetza, owns a house on our property.
So not just figuratively you're close with your family, but literally.
My nephew and his wife live in my niece's house, a different part of the family. And me and my wife and two kids live in the house on the back. And you know, this is one of the unique aspects of living and raising families and building on reserve, is that there's a variety of different rules on the reserves. And in some cases, there are no rules, and that's a problem as well. But this allowed for us to build what a lot of people call the Olsen family compound. And it's this really unique living experience where we look after each other and we live with each other. And, you know, my sister Heather's around often. Her kids are around often. My niece is around. And so, yeah, family is really important to me. My dad just lives down the road. My mom just lives in North Saanich. And so we see a lot of each other, and it's a really important part of who I am.
Okay, right on. Well, I'm going to get back to the family aspect of things, because I always like to find out more about people's parents specifically, but the direction I want to go right now is how you started on the path towards politics. But I guess maybe let's take the long and winding road there as to what were you doing during high school and maybe just after high school, and what led to the inspiration to get into politics?
It's interesting how you characterized it, because as I was driving up here to thinking about how I got here. It's kind of how it was framed in the email, and just to frame the conversation. I got here the long and winding road. I took the long way here. And in fact, quite ironic that you would frame it this way. I've not taken the shortcut anywhere. I am here because, I'm in this position because I'm a product of the community that I was raised in. I'm a product of the circumstances, being of mixed heritage, of having a place on an Indian reserve in this country. It creates political people. You are inherently politicized if you are an Indian Act Indian on an Indian reserve governed by the Indian Act. You are by nature politicized. And so for me, I really, I'd say struggled with it, but I think grew with that understanding through the 1990s when I was in high school. And we had some, you know, family turmoil at the exact same time as I was going through high school. And so I'm a guy that, you know, was challenged with completing high school. It took me a couple of extra years to get through it. And then I went off and worked in the restaurant industry as a waiter and a variety of different roles as a frontline worker in the service industry. As I talked about last fall, I'm someone that has struggled, that had, you know, back in the day, struggled with substance use, abuse, addiction to some extent, and really wanted to share that story because of the experience that so many people in our society are having right now. That's my story as well. I've seen substance use and abuse around me, you know, my whole life. It's been a part of the narrative of the family and of the result of the really unfortunate result of residential and day schools is addiction and substance use. And so, you know, kind of an unlikely person to end up really in politics. But it was that politicization that I in high school, I had a buddy, still a friend of mine, Nathan Isberg, he really good guy. And we did a lot of reading and a lot of talking, a lot of movie watching, or, you know, around the political philosophy and kind of nerded out on politics in high school. Watched Noam Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent probably four or five too many times.
Yes.
So really kind of informed by, you know, how society is structured, how governance happens, how good governance happens, how we communicate with each other. And I have an inherent ability to communicate with humans. And that's kind of something that I recognized early on in my life, that I am very comfortable. I'm comfortable standing in front of people and talking to them. I'm comfortable answering questions. I have no issues with telling people what I actually think and speaking truthfully or honestly about what I'm thinking. I don't fear their response to it because I do it in a very open and just in an innocent way, just saying, this is what I think the situation is. So, you know, that all of those traits and those personal strengths really play into the kind of work that I'm doing. And it really played into the work that I was doing in the restaurant industry, waiting tables. And to a great extent, I view the work that I do today, and this isn't to diminish the work that I do, because I want to elevate the work that waiters and waitresses, the wait staff do in our society, in navigating different people and navigating different situations, in working in intense, high energy environments. You know, I think we often undermine the incredible work that frontline service people do. And really today, that's exactly what I am, is I'm a frontline service worker whose responsibility is to advocate on behalf of people. I love people. I love being around people. I love communicating with people. And so the long answer to the short question is, I took the long way to get here. I'm still taking the long way to get here. I'm looking forward to going and completing the bits of school that I had started and abandoned and started and abandoned. And that's certainly within the short to medium term goals that I have as a person is to ensure that my academic and my educational experience matches and reflects the on the ground frontline experience that I've gained and had the benefit of gaining as an elected official for the last 15 years.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a lot of different directions it could possibly go here. I had a couple of things that I'm just taking away from what you said there. First of all, about being a service worker and having to navigate different people in different situations, it does take a lot of energy. I've never personally been a waiter, but boy, oh boy, it seems like a tough gig. And I always actually really love when people are really themselves in that position. I find that's the hardest thing to do as somebody who's a customer, to when I see a server who's actually comfortable enough to just be themselves and not put on a performance, because I see that as being incredibly difficult, and I always value that. You mentioned the substance abuse issue, which I'm not familiar with, but I'll just share with you is that my father passed away when I was 20 because of jaundice of the liver, and alcoholism was a feature of my growing up, and I think it's a feature of many people's experience, and it's kind of amazes me sometimes just how common alcohol is in our lives. I don't know your situation in particular, if you feel like talking about that a little bit, but yeah, it's a challenging world we live in, and it seems as if the amount of substance abuse out there is pretty rampant.
Yeah, so first on the service working, I think one of the things that I really value about my experience working in the service industry is that it really showed me how I'm a multidimensional person. And because largely waiters generate their income from tips,
yeah,
it requires you to really find ways to engage with people the way they want to be engaged. And there's a whole pile of different types of people sitting at those tables. Some people are tourists and they want to know about the city that they're visiting because they don't know anything about it. Some people are having an anniversary dinner and they want you as far away from the table as possible, and they just want the wine and the food and, you know, whatever. And so there's a variety of different customers who are there for a variety of different reasons. And it's really important for the person who's serving that table to be able to pick up on those cues. And if you're clumsy at it, then you're going to not do well in the industry. You're not going to like the job, and they're not going to like you as their server. It's going to be more difficult. Let's just put it that way. So for me, I found that I was able to read the room, for lack of a better term. I could walk up to a table and I could feel, I was vibing with those people. I could feel what it was that they were looking for. And if not by the first or second sentence out of their mouth, I was able to deliver the kind of service, because I'm a multidimensional person. I'm able to be very much right there, the actor, the person that's, you know, larger than life, providing them an experience as they visit the city for the first time, or the person who's there to just bring them the food and give them a very professional, very quiet, just here I am, there you are, and that's what it needs to be. So I think that those skills that I learned are very much transferable to politics. I walk into a room, I can feel the temperature of that room immediately. I can adjust myself to be the same temperature, and it's not a chameleon type where you want to get lost in the room. It's understanding that people are looking for certain things, and if you're able to identify that early on, then you can be successful. And I really largely attribute the success that I had being and waiting tables, and the desire that I have to go back at some point in my life and wait tables again, because I just love that frontline experience, engaging with people at that level, to attributing that to the success that I've had, relative success that I've had as an elected official and getting elected and engaging with people. Walking up to a door and knocking on a stranger's door is very similar to walking up to a table and knocking on the table of strangers who, you know, they present themselves at a restaurant, you present them yourself at the door, but there's all sorts of telltale signs all around their house, what it is that you're walking up to. And if you can read that, you can, and I've got an interesting story if you want to hear it, but
yeah, for sure.
I want to get to the substance aspect of this. You know, I'll just say, I think that it's only stigma that has held us back from talking about the experience that we have as humans in using substances. Using substances as medicine, largely because of trauma that you've experienced at younger parts of your life. That I was traumatized. I got a whole part of the story that I haven't told you about, growing up in a Christian, very strict Christian religion. And I suffered some trauma from that specific experience that I had. I suffered trauma with the turmoil in my family and a breakup of my parents. That's a traumatic experience. I suffered trauma from having the residential and day school experience and intergenerational trauma that gets handed down. So I think that largely we've put on a brave face and tried to smile our way through it and not really be honest with ourselves or with each other, that we've all faced these traumas and we find ways to cope with that. And substances are, they are a way that we cope with the trauma that we've experienced in our lives. And it's a way for us to not necessarily have to talk about the trauma that we've experienced, to put it in its place. And so, you know, I think that when I opened up and had an interview with Rob Shaw from Czech, and he did a story about it, and I did a 2-minute statement about it in the legislature. I'm on the record. I've talked about it. I'm open to talking about it whenever. I was at the International Overdose Awareness Day, Mum Stop the Harm hosted that. Good friend Leslie McBain, who lives on the island, invited me to that. This is where I first talked about my experiences with illicit substances. And it's only the stigma that has made these conversations uncomfortable and weird. So, you know, unfortunately, I can say in most instances where people tell me that they've also experienced this in one way, shape, or form, whether it be a family member or with themselves, it's not surprising, because I think that we're all, in some ways, and now in our society, you can go to a doctor and be professionally medicated with many of the same root substances as that we're medicating ourselves with, you know, on our own. So I wanted to share the story publicly, partly because there's this stigma around politicians that, I was told a couple of times years ago, you share that story, your political career will be over.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know, what the hell is that about? My story is the same as everybody's story.
Yeah.
I'm not special. And in fact, it's only this idea that I'm not allowed to share it that's making me seem like I'm different from everybody else. But as a community leader, I damn well have to share this story. I have to let people know and normalize it and destigmatize it. I've got to be a part of that, or else I'm not being honest with my constituents. I'm not being honest with myself. I'm not being honest with my family. It's a dishonest thing to keep it hidden and to pretend like it doesn't exist. So, you know, I wanted to share the story because far too many of the people who are dying of drug poisonings in our province right now look like you and I, frankly. They're our age, 40s to 60s, you know, say 30s to 60s, men who have not been enabled or empowered to talk about the traumas that they're facing in a way that allows them to work through it. And I wanted to just put my hand up and say, hey, you look like me. You think that I'm, you know, successful in what I've been elected 4 times. I've tried 5 times to be elected. That's successful to an extent, but I've got this story as well. Mm-hmm. And you're okay to share your story. I'm going to share my story. We're all just going to be honest about the situation that we faced collectively. And to me, it just made sense to share that.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And it's a super vulnerable thing. And I sincerely appreciate you going into that. And I think that it only benefits us as individuals and us as the whole when we share our personal traumas that we face. And, you know, because it's something that you said that as being somebody, a public figure, you're supposed to be some sort of picture perfect individual. And that's like, what kind of pressure is that to put on people, and how false of a reality is that? It doesn't seem like it's a very healthy thing. But what I have seen in my own personal life is that when people do open up and express their vulnerabilities, it really makes me feel more empathetic. It brings me closer to them, and it makes me look at my own issues as well too. And it just turns into a far more real experience.
That's terrible advice for political operatives to be telling the people that they're handling and the people that they're working with to not be honest or to share their experiences. It's It's exactly what we need in our houses of governance, are people with diverse experiences.
Yeah.
I'm able to sit in a meeting that where we're talking about illicit substance use and go, oh yeah, no, I no, actually you're wrong on that, at least not from my experience, right? So we want diversity in legislative assemblies, in sitting around the council table, sitting around the Islands Trust table, sitting around the CRD. We want that diversity to be of experiences to be there. We want to make these places accessible to people of a variety of socioeconomic standings.
Sure.
We want people who've experienced poverty to be sitting at the table. Because if only wealthy people are people who've experienced wealth are sitting at the table, they are darn well not going to do very well for people who've experienced poverty. Because the privilege is going to cloud their judgment on things. Not intentionally, unintentionally. And that's probably the more dangerous aspect of it, actually, is that they're not going to realize that they might be doing more harm than good. But if you've got somebody who's experienced homelessness or someone who's experienced poverty or someone who's experienced substance use sitting at the table, and they've not been marginalized out of it because, well, that would be a politically dangerous thing for you to admit.
Yeah.
So, you know, the reality is that our democracy needs to be populated by a fair representation of the public that's being represented.
Thank you again. Let's get more into the backstory here. You mentioned about being a waiter and serving and finding a passion for that and a joy within doing it. What other jobs did you have before leading into deciding to go into the world of politics?
So I went from waiting tables, and I, you know, one of the best experiences that I had as a young man, as a teenager, was working at Butchart Gardens in the dining room restaurant. I still have work habits today that they trained me with. So hands up to Butchart's for giving me a really solid foundation to work off of. And I went into the applied communication program at Camosun, was one of the bits of education that I started. And I guess in one way I finished it, because at that point of the applied communication program, there were three ways to get out of that program. And it was recognized that there were three ways. You could graduate and get your certificate, which is, you know, when you start an education program, that's the desirable one. You want to finish it. You drop out because it wasn't for you. And you know, that's fine too. You identify that this isn't, or you job out. And I jobbed out. I got accepted to the TSN, the sports network in Toronto. I got accepted to their internship for 5 months, worked in Sports Center, putting together highlight packages. It was cool. I wanted to go into sports broadcasting. The goal when I went into that program in 2003, the Olympics were just announced for Vancouver. The goal was to call the gold medal winning game of the men's and women's hockey.
Okay.
That's what I wanted to call. And that was the goal, become a play-by-play announcer in hockey. So I applied, got the job at TSN, went off. And then before, I did like a job interview, job shadow with the Victoria Salmon Kings, which was an ECHL hockey team in Victoria for a while, just for a minute, and went off and did that. And they called me when I was away and they said, look, we're looking for a communications person. You seem to be the right guy for the job. We're a mess right now. We need staff. Will you come and work for us? And I said, well, I'm going to finish this internship and then I'll be back and I'll make the decision. I ended up leaving school and jobbing out. I got a job with the Victoria Salmon Kings, became their communications and community relations manager, became the community relations and communications manager for the Save on Foods Memorial Center over the big arena in Victoria, 7,000 seat arena that was over budget and over and late in delivery. And so there was all sorts of crisis communications that I got thrown into the middle of. I got the opportunity to follow a hockey team around for a while. That was cool. I got the opportunity to be the communications and media relations daytime guy for a bunch of really high level share. The Black Eyed Peas came through, the Ford Curling World Championships. There's a bunch of events that I got the chance to be a communications, WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment. Yeah. That was a fun one. And those athletes really hammer themselves. I would say it's fake and it's set up, but my goodness, they are incredible athletes.
I don't know how they don't have bruises. Doesn't make any sense.
They do.
Me.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
they
body,
hide them well.
Body tanner or whatever. Okay. Anyway, so I did that. And then I met my partner. She was acting at the time. We were looking at the fact that it was largely going to be that she was going to be off acting and I was going to be off following a hockey team around during the winter. And we had to sit down and had a conversation. Is this the lifestyle that we want, or do we want something different than that? And we agreed that we wanted to settle and to have a family eventually, and that this lifestyle of following a hockey team around wasn't going to work. And so I abandoned the idea of becoming a play-by-play commentator right at the same time as the Victoria Salmon Kings hired a play-by-play commentator, which interesting timing. And then I went off and worked at the University of Victoria in athletics and recreation as a sponsorship and marketing guy for their sports teams. And Emily got pregnant with our first child, Silas. And she had a really great job at Canada Post. And so we were looking at this going, okay, what are we going to do? We've brought this child into this world. Are we going to have daycare? Or is one of us going to work from home? And because I had this communications background, I could contract. So I decided to be a work from home dad. And it was at the exact same time that Central Saanich counselor Zeb King started to knock on my door to say, hey, have you ever thought about getting into politics? And I was like, yeah, back in 94, when I was watching Noam Chomsky manufacturing consent, I was, you know, and debating political philosophy with my buddies back in high school. I did think that this might be a job. I never thought that it was going to be a real thing. And in 2008, I got elected, and that has really set me off on the path that I'm on right now. And I've continued to try to get elected and continued to be successful so far. And, you know, I'd say that history, how I got here, is really, I think, the example of how I've taken the long way to get to be where I'm at. It wasn't a poli-sci degree. It wasn't this desire to be in an elected role. I got here because I started on this journey and just persisted with it and continued to build and learn. And it always hasn't always been the easiest or most direct route. In fact, most of the time I'm going around and I'm learning things on my own, or not on my own, but I'm reaching out to people and getting them to advise me and to educate me and carry me along.
Okay. First off, this could be the most important question of the whole podcast, and that is, are you a Canucks fan?
No.
Oh, no! No! This is terrible. Terrible news. Okay. Well, as a lifelong Canucks fan...
So if I'm not a Canucks fan...
I'm going to say Oilers?
No.
Oh, okay. Who else could it be? 80s? Because we were born in the same year. We were born in 76. So I grew up in the 80s watching hockey. And I have an affinity for the Oilers as well, too. Okay, let's hear it.
Leafs.
The Leafs. Okay. All right. Yeah. The Leafs, yeah.
So, I mean, and there's a backstory to this as well. My dad grew up on Sartlip at a time when there was six hockey teams. And, I mean, there are Avalanche fans, and they're happy right now. And there are Canucks fans, but they came after, obviously. But there are families that are Habs fans, and there are families that are Leafs fans. And that was because there was a television, and the families would get together and watch Hockey Night in Canada.
Yeah.
And half the room would be this, and half the room would be that. And we ended up being my uncles, my dad, everybody. And so I did not grow up. And, you know, I think maybe you could parallel my love for the Toronto Maple Leafs with my love for running for a political party that had no experience electing people in the BC Greens, right? Like, I did not cheer for a winning hockey team ever. I never have cheered for a winning hockey team. And maybe this is an example of taking the long way around, right?
Sure. So. Well, you and me both. I haven't cheered for a winning hockey team because the Leafs and the Canucks are both without Stanley Cups during our lives on this earth. But and the people listening, you should have seen the look he gave me when I asked if he was a Canucks fan. Oh boy.
Well, if you're a West Coast born and raised Leafs fan, you have to have a special feeling for the Canucks because everything is calling you to be the hometown fan.
Yeah.
Right. So so I'm not going to get into how I feel about the Canucks or how I felt about the Canucks. I'm a bit agnostic on it now, but anyway.
Fair enough. Okay, so you mentioned earlier as well too. So the gentleman, I can't remember his name. You said it was Eb. Who
Zeb.
Okay, excuse me. Okay, so this gentleman knocked on your door and asked if you wanted to get involved in politics. Who was this person, and why did he reach out to you?
That's another interesting story. Zeb was a longtime member of Central Saanich Council. He's still on Central Saanich Council, actually. He ran against me in the last provincial election for the BCNDP. He knocked on my door asking me if I had ever considered engaging in the official community plan, saying that the District of Central Saanich has never had many Indigenous people engaged, and I live on a reserve, so he came across the street and knocked on my door. And would I engage in the official community plan? And I said, no, absolutely not. Why would I ever want to engage in an official community planning? That sounds so boring. I've got no interest in it at all. And he left and went away. And then the district continued on the process for the official community plan. And a couple weeks later, he shows back up on my door. Well, we've got a municipal election coming along. Have you ever considered municipal politics? And I said, now there, I'd be interested in having a conversation. So ironically enough, I was interested in having the conversation about running for council, but not interested at all in having a conversation about the most important document that the council was developing, which was an important learning lesson for me, that if you're going to be on council, you actually have to engage, you have to engage those planning processes. So anyway, he also felt that it was important for there to be Indigenous voices around the council table. And, you know, his patience that he took with me as we met many Saturdays in a row, and he encouraged me to run. I ran. I won. He did not win in that election, actually. He ran again the following election, and we were on council briefly together for about a year and a bit before I stepped away to run provincially. And he's been on municipal council since, and I've gone on the pathway of provincial politics. And then we end up showing up on the same stage again in 2020. And as we were looking across the stage at each other, he was the NDP candidate and I was the Green candidate. And I actually just wrote you should see it in the Pender Post, actually. I just wrote a piece where I was raising my hands up to him in gratitude for inviting me into this line of work. It's been very good. I've enjoyed myself. I enjoy myself. Shouldn't make it sound like it's past tense. I still enjoy myself, and very thankful. And now encouraging people to consider putting their name on the ballot and serving their communities at a local level with the local government elections coming up this October.
Okay. You obviously had some sort of a prior relationship or acquaintance with this individual. What was it that made him decide to reach out to you and ask? And obviously, how pivotal is that? If that conversation didn't happen, would you have ever gone down the road of actually getting into local politics, do you think?
Oh, no, I don't think so at all. No, it required several weeks of us having conversations about what it meant, what was involved with it. So, no, I definitely would not have been involved if he didn't invite me, first of all, to have the conversation, and second of all, be so persistent when I told him several times no. So we knew each other because my mom ran for the 2005, I think it was, federal NDP nomination for Saanich Gulf Islands.
Oh, okay. All right.
And she, I think, lost by about 6 votes.
What?
And then we moved on from the NDP after that. And then Elizabeth May showed up and we started having conversations with Elizabeth May. Then I was elected by then as a municipal councillor with no party affiliation, and initially I was going to run as an independent, and that is a futile cause in this province unless you get elected and then leave a party. Getting elected as an independent is almost impossible. Another challenge that I have with our political system, but for another day, and maybe a different podcast, but nonetheless, yeah. So anyway, Zeb knew our family. He helped my mom's campaign because he was a longtime NDP supporter. And so he helped my mom's campaign, I believe. And that's how I got on his radar.
Okay. All right. Well, let's hit the pause button in that particular aspect of your life. And then we're going to go back to your parents here, because you mentioned your mom again. And I said I wanted to get back and talk about your parents, who sound really fascinating. But let's start with your mom. What's your mom's first name?
Sylvia.
Sylvia, you mentioned that. Excuse me.
She's going to hate that I just did that, but Bub.
Bub.
I'm sharing that with you because when you ask me about my dad, I've got something else to say. But Sylvia is my mom's name.
Okay.
She's an author.
Yeah.
Sylvia Olson. She's published 21 times or something like that.
Wow.
She writes kids' books. She writes knitting books. And her partner, Tex, own and operate the Saturnal Lodge now on Saturn Island. And yeah.
All right. And so, and she probably had an influence in you running for politics. It sounds like that she ran in 2005 for the NDP.
Reluctantly, I think she ran.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know that it was necessary. I mean, she was convinced, like I was convinced to run. She was convinced. We were not a political family. We were a religious family growing up. And, you know, I think ultimately we got involved in politics because we replaced the community around the church with the community around the politics. And when we left the church, and again, another podcast, maybe another podcast series at another time, there was a huge hole in our lives because we spent so much time with the families that were a part of that church. And so for me, at least, I won't speak for her, but for me, getting involved in politics and with a political party, there's a lot of community that's involved in that. And so I think that it probably filled a hole that was left there when we left the church in the mid-1990s.
Okay. And you said she lives on Saturna Island now.
It's in North Saanich, but her and her partner own the Saturna Lodge and operate it.
Okay. Excuse me. And then your dad, he said...
Carl.
Carl. Okay.
Carl Olson.
Carl
also
Olson.
Nicknamed Bub.
Yeah. Okay.
And not after they met. They were both Bub before they met each other.
Oh, what?
So that's why I wanted to share. Yeah.
Okay.
So Bub and Bub.
All right.
So my nephews or my cousins know Uncle Bub and Auntie Bub. they both don't
it
go
must
by.
Be a first in the world. I can't imagine anywhere else in the world such a thing has existed.
There's lots of firsts in my family. I can't imagine that there is that either. Neither of them go by Bub.
Okay.
Anymore. Although we just started a book club with my dad, reading indigenous authors, and we called it Bub's Book Club because it sounds better than Carl's Book Club.
Sure, yeah.
I think somewhat reluctantly we called it Bub's. He agreed. And my mom definitely does not go by Bub anymore. But I wanted to share that because I think it was a unique little thing that back in the 1970s, they found each other and both their childhood nicknames were Bub.
That's pretty funny. Pretty funny. So your dad has a book club that he's starting dealing with indigenous books.
That's right. So we're starting later in July and we're starting with The Inconvenient Indian. He's done this a couple of times now, started book clubs. And really as a Hussein-ich elder has a unique perspective about how this country has evolved and formed. And I think has a very unique perspective to share with people. And so this is a really great way to do it. And we've got 15 people, I think, so far signed up. You're more than welcome to sign up. I'll give you my email. You can send me if you want to join the book club.
I actually really do need to join a book club, quite
well,
honestly.
Well,
my wife's part of one. I'm a little jealous, actually. It seems like such a beautiful thing.
Let's start one. I mean, this was a great way to have some of the more difficult conversations in our society right now around reconciliation, what it means, And really, I think the fear that people have about how it's going to impact them personally. There's lots of rumors and lots of misinformation about Indigenous people and Indigenous rights and what it means to the rest of society. This is a great way to have an open conversation. My dad's a really articulate guy, and so yeah, he's the right guy to do it.
Okay. Actually, I'm just curious about that. Why do you think such a lot of fear exists around that subject as to what is going to happen with reconciliation? And why do you think that that's somewhat of a pervasive idea in people's minds?
I think it's mostly because so much misinformation from the government has been put out there and has been allowed to foment. So sometimes it's not the government that's putting the information out, but they've certainly not tried to correct the record on a lot of this stuff. So, you know, and mostly in this country, you can not go too far without running into an Indian reserve. And so there's lots of questions about why does an Indian reserve look like that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what the hell is going on here in this country if that's happening? And so then then people without information start to fill in the blanks on their own. That it must be because those indigenous people are whatever their mind creates.
Mm-hmm.
And then that becomes the real thing.
It makes me laugh because I think that's how we operate as human beings all the time. It's like, I have a little bit of information and let me fill in the rest of the gaps with just whatever comes to mind and makes sense.
And I think the other thing is that it's becoming understood in our society that the greatest conflict that we have in Canada is over land and land ownership, and that our Crown governments have not been honest about the true ownership of the land. The courts have been telling us since the 1950s, 1960s, in court case after court case after court case, what you see here does not exist as you see it. It exists in another, in a different way. And nobody really knows what that way is. It's not been explained. And so I think people mostly in this country, my experience, they want it sorted out, but also they want to know how sorting it out is going to impact them personally. We have also been told in parallel that the greatest investment that you can make is in your house and in creating that nest for yourself. And so if the land that that house is on has not been legally obtained, but there's some legitimate legal questions around that, then there's fear. And I understand that fear because it's been manufactured and it's not been answered and it's not been forthright as the governments try to be less than honest about what the situation is on the landscape, not clearly identify the conflict, the central conflict, which is about land. So we have work to do. And the work that we have to do is to let people know that, look, sorting this out doesn't necessarily or in any way threaten what you've got going on here. It just means that the governments that have allowed this to persist need to get damn creative about it. And they need to get out of their own heads on this and start thinking outside the box about how they can solve it. Because the longer that it's allowed to just languish, the more we hurt Indigenous people, the more Indigenous people are hurt, the more we injure our society.
Absolutely.
This is not, and I just be clear about it, this is not an Indian problem, an Indigenous problem. This is a broader societal problem that we're all part of. If we allow this to persist, the relationship with Indigenous people and Crown governments to persist the way it is, that is a situation that is hurting all of our society. We are not the best society we can be as long as these relationships are the way they are, as long as Crown governments think that it's entirely the decision making is up to them, that the revenue collection is entirely theirs. It's not the case. And courts will continue to rule the way that they've been ruling as long as Crown governments try to maintain power, authority, and control over everything. And it won't be a worse place when Indigenous nations are part of the decision making and part of the revenue generation off of the land base, whether it be through resource extraction or taxation, like the property transfer tax, like the way that the provincial government does it. It will be better for our society if Indigenous nations are generating wealth and living in a wealthy situation, because as I know, we invest in our territories, we invest in our homes and in our lands, and that's to everybody's benefit. And so, you know, it's really about reframing the conversation, and I think that that's what this book club will allow for us to do for the people who join it. Can I plug it?
Yeah, go for
Bub's
it, please.
Book club.
Yeah, yeah.
Email me at sahunup@gmail.com, sahunup@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. And I'll add you to the list. And we're going to have, and because this is a podcast, I don't want to time date it too much, but the first meeting will be on July 24th. And then we're going to meet on the second and fourth Sunday of the month. And we're going to be working through a bunch of books. We've got, I think we're going to do Standoff. We're going to do 21 Things You Didn't Know About the Indian Act. We're going to do probably Indigenomics. So like there's a bunch of books now that we can cruise through and have really good quality conversations about, and start to, I think, erode some of the fear that's around this and recognize that once we get this right, we're going to be a much, much better society.
I love this. This sounds so great, right? Because I think the idea of coming up with creative solutions to problems, about being able to give people an opportunity to learn and get engaged in something, is a wonderful thing, right? And that's partly what this podcast is about as well, too. I love having an opportunity, people speaking about their lives and showing, wow, this individual is far more dynamic than, you know, we really give them credit for, because we just see them as this very one-dimensional human that we don't really know much about, like their past experiences or the current things that they're participating in their lives right now. But the idea of the book club sounds incredible. Very, very creative and very cool. Right on. lastly, let's just end off with, I guess, your transition into politics, because it started with municipal politics and then eventually it led to provincial politics. But maybe just one question that I was curious about is that what sort of idea did you have about becoming a politician and getting invested in that world that was potentially a misconception that was changed through your experience of being a public representative? And how have you changed as an individual during this time?
It's only going to be about 15 to 20 hours a week. That's the biggest misconception. You know, I think in recruiting political candidates, you need to be honest about the level of involvement that this job requires. If you're putting 15 to 20 hours a week into this job, and I think I've kind of made fun of that comment a lot because, you know, it was a lot more work than I initially thought it was going to be. And so the biggest misconception is just how deeply involved you become in the community. And the longer you do it, the more well-known you become in the community and the less of yourself that you have on your own. So, you know, I would say that I've become very comfortable being a very public person. COVID actually, in an interesting way, and wearing masks allowed me for the first time to go to the grocery store and not have to talk about the condition of the road pavement or the healthcare system, or because I got to put on a hat and a mask and I got to go in and get the milk and I got to go out and I didn't have to have the I make it sound like I didn't want the conversation, but sometimes you just need to get eggs.
Of course.
You know,
course,
yeah. And it's just the only reason why I'm here is to get eggs. I know that you don't have a family doctor, and I know that at least 20% of my population in my riding doesn't have the, but you know, it comes with the territory that over time, if you spend enough time in this line of work, you're going to be well known. And if you do it well, if you do the job well and you make yourself available to people, you're going to become very well known in the community. And so preparing yourself to kind of lose a chunk of the anonymity that everybody else in society has, the ability to go to the grocery store or to go to the restaurant and just have somebody, you know, read the paper or Twitter as I do, but you know, nothing can really prepare you for that. And I made the decision, you know, fairly shortly after my re-election in Central Saanich to consider running provincially because, frankly, I was tired at how much downloading the provincial government was doing on local governments. And I thought the only way to stop the downloading was to get involved in provincial government and stop it. And Elizabeth May got elected and the BC Green Party started to call me in and asked if I'd ever considered running. I worked on Elizabeth's campaign in the background as a municipal councillor. And so that was kind of the path to the provincial government. Now I've got the hiccups.
That's okay.
And you're going to hear this last one.
And I know you have to get going because you're going to be going to our local bakery and I guess meeting with people for the next 2 hours. So we'll let you get out of here. But is there anything else you want to say just to wrap this up? Any final thoughts?
No, this was a great opportunity to just connect and talk about things that I don't normally get to talk about. So I appreciate this opportunity and I appreciate, and I've got the hiccups. It's a terrible way to end the interview, but I really appreciate this opportunity.
Yeah, I appreciate you. Thank you for coming over. Thank you.
All right, everybody, there we go. Adam Olson, that was great. Thank you so much to Adam again for that interview. I really enjoyed doing that. And if you enjoyed what you heard and you'd like to go back and listen to some older interviews with some amazing people who live on Pender Island, I have about 50 of them. So if you want to get to learn more about some of the residents that make up our beautiful island, you can check those out. Or if you want to hear some future interviews, please feel free to subscribe to the podcast. You can do that through Podbean. And as I mentioned before, you can find me in various places, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Like I said in the beginning, stay tuned for some great interviews coming up in the near future here. But that's then, and this is now, and all I got to say to end off is thank you to Ben McConkie for the music for this podcast, and thank you for listening. Until next time.